And welcome to the Recovery Radio Show, broadcasting on www.enlightenradio.org. And you can always catch our player at player.enlightenradio.org and our old podcast at podcast.enlightenradio.org. Welcome to the Recovery Radio Show, hosted by James Boyd, and of course myself is talking along with him. And the title of this show is There's Nothing Between Here and the North Pole But a Barbed Wire Fence, broadcast on July the 13th, 2023, Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. You can catch us live.
With that, there's nothing here, nothing. What is it? There's nothing between here
and the North Pole but a barbed wire fence.
The North Pole.
You know, there's not a single tree to block the wind, you know, you could...
Nothing here but a barbed wire fence between here and the North Pole.
So, and it's nothing but tundra, yeah, you know.
So And you're in your
70s
right now. Yeah. So your grandfather...
So that was 1966. Mm-hmm. You know, I got married... because my girlfriend got pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, my dad, he was from Kansas. So if I went to school out in Kansas, you know, I could get in-state Kansas tuition still based on the fact that his grandfather was still living there. And it was cheap. It really was. Like, I mean, I think it was roughly about $50 per class per semester. So what's that? I was you take 3 to 4 classes at a time maybe in college. So that's like $150, $200 per a semester, right? And then you had housing. So that was the main cost, really.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were married and you had a kid, which we did by that time, his name is Chris. He lives out in California now. And then you could get a reduced rate, you know, also. So I think we were living for under $100 rent for sure.
Wow. You know, wow. There's nothing here.
Two bedrooms.
There's nothing between us here and the North Pole but what?
A barbed wire fence.
A barbed wire fence and what?
That's
there's
it.
Two things.
Well, no, there's just nothing between here and the North Pole.
And the North Pole.
Because it's just flat. There's no trees, nothing all the way to go through Manitoba, Canada, all the way up to the Arctic Circle. I mean, there's a few hills in western South Dakota, North Dakota, the Black Hills, right where the Sioux Nation retreated to at one point.
There's nothing between here and the North Pole but a barbed wire fence. There's nothing between Amarillo and the North Pole except a barbed wire fence.
So I put in
a question to Google, and I said the etymology of a statement. There's nothing between here and the North Pole
but a barbed wire fence. Yeah. What's it come back with?
Yeah, what does that mean? Yeah, what does that mean? So we looked that up. And, you know, I've been in some strange towns, man, with names that have a basis for the name. Or what was going through your grandfather's, you know, what was
There's
going
lots
on?
Of,
oh, you say he was looking for real estate.
No, he was mainly thinking about the people going crazy. You know, like Western Kansas, when he was raised, he was born, what, maybe 1880, something like that.
Wow.
You know, something like that, anyway. And, you know, his father had come there as a teenager in 1876, I think, something like that. Whenever General Custer went west to Montana with the 7th Cavalry, my great-grandfather traveled with him because his only surviving relative, so the story goes, was his aunt, who was married to General Custer. And so He tried, but they left him in Abilene, Kansas. You know, and so he was like 14, 15 years old, maybe 15 by then. And he had a sister with him who was like 6 or 7 at the time. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, young, a kid, right? And but he managed to, I don't know, maybe somebody did it for him. He managed to file a claim on, I think it started out as 300 acres, which you could get almost for nothing, as long as if he lied about his age. Probably lied about a lot of shit, actually.
This is your grandfather.
Yeah, my great grandfather. And, you know, he later became a kind of a, he became pretty wealthy, actually, because once the railroad got to a town headed west in the, like, 1870s, that's when the big thing.
Mm-hmm.
It started out as a project that Lincoln had, right? You know, we're going to build a transcontinental railroad, right? And mm-hmm. as it got farther, but the big thing about going west was that every town it would get to, well, now that town could ship things like beef, cattle, for example, back to Chicago, where there was a market, right? And, you know, you could get paid cash money. Now imagine what you're going to get paid cash money for in 1850 Western Kansas. Nothing, okay? There's nothing for sale, you know. I mean, you can trade with the Native Americans, right, or somebody else, or grow it yourself, but forget it, or hunt it down, you know, kill it for pelts or whatever. But even as a if you're doing like you know, animal pelts or stuff like that, beavers and stuff like that, well, how are you going to get it to market? That's a big effing deal, you know, when you're out there in the middle of nowhere. Who are you going to sell it to?
That's a great metaphor, John. Keep you going. Hey, man. So to me, I mean, we go, like I said last week. I said, well, John and I, we have protocol, but we make it up as we go. And usually when we get on, we spark up a conversation. So I come up with a couple of questions, which, to me, you know, how can we tie it all in to and bring it to today? And so the barbed wire metaphor, you know, we can kind of structure it around that. And I'd like to ask you some questions and you give me some answers, because you're pretty keen at that, especially about, you know, I can joke around and talk trash on the air, and, you know, but you give real pertinent information that can be traced back to a lot of the things that we're trying to solve right now. You know, it's just that to enlighten people about how you put the two pieces together and how strong of a bond degradation and systematic degradation and some other things, how it works on the psyche and it can hold you up for hundreds of years if it's not put on display, for one, for people to see. Because you take the barbed wire. So the question is, where did the barbed wire fence come from? That's a good metaphor. You use a lot of good metaphors, John. So it'll give us some class, man. And we could do that, this part right here, at maybe the closing part of the show, because we got the option to cut it off when we want to, so we don't bore right. people half.
Yeah.
But I think, and to me, the way you do things and what you can talk about, African Americans can look at that and really get a picture of what's you know what, like we're the odd couple, yeah. I believe in
yes.
this, right? Right. I mean, right. two different places. But you know, I asked a dude yesterday at where I work, you know, white guy, young white guy, and I said, man, you used to be black, didn't you? You know, I mean, he was young. He said, yeah. Come on. I told him, I'll pull him to the side. It was hot as hell out there too, John. And, you know, people need something to laugh about. And he was doing really well. He was serious about his program. And, you know, he had his gear on. And,
yeah.
you know, he's in the rehab. And I said, and all the other residents go around him, and you know, he was playing the beanbag toss. My mom was like, man, he was singing and stuff. I said, man, you used to be black, didn't you? He fell out.
He could relate.
Yeah.
He could relate.
You know. Yeah. But see, there's a downside to that. When you do that, you start getting so many handshakes and stuff, man. You'd be like, man, it's time to go. I'm getting off in 15 minutes. Can we kind of bring this to a halt?
Yeah.
Want to shake. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Doing dap. Hey, man.
Right.
And then the supervisor, but see, you don't know, I got a game plan too, because I knew over my shoulder that the supervisor, the real boss, had just stepped out of the door.
Oh shit! Yeah, right. Okay.
And so I needed for him to see.
Good. That's good. I like that. Yeah. Right.
I needed for him to see that.
All right, keep it up.
And so, and so to me, yeah.
Anyway, so what happened next?
So we, you know, but that's a whole segment, John, and I think that we can break it down, because you pretty good with metaphors, you know.
The barbed wire fence also occurred one another time. I remember we were in the union and we were being trained on how to negotiate contracts. What is a contract? And I remember the general secretary of, Secretary Treasurer of the union, he says, it's a barbed wire fence. And what does that mean? You know, and he says, well, you know, if you try to run right through it, you're going to get cut. But you can stick your hand through it and your feet, you know, and you can reach in the other side and you can let the grass grow right through it if you want, you know, and the wind goes right through it, you know. So there ain't going to be any... you know, protection from the wind, whatever you want to call the wind in corporate relations. The wind.
Wind, that's right.
You know, the announcement that there will be layoffs, okay? It's a who.
You know. That's a singing group, man.
right.
That's a rock band.
No, that's the owl on the roof, you know, going, who?
Oh, who? 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 Who?
I don't know.
Ooh, yeah,
so that was another usage.
And that's a good metaphor, Don. Look at what I just pulled up. Did the invention of barbed wire fence affect the XIT ranch? The XIT began using windmills in 1887, including one that was approximately 10 stories tall. Barbed wire and windmills brought about the closing of the once open range.
Right.
What about the closing of the once open range? Now, here's another question. How did the barbed wire affect the Native Americans?
Wow. The barbed wire was you're trying to, first of all, keep the cattle from wandering, okay, or the herds, you know, whatever. But, you know, the open range, that's the only place you could hunt buffalo, and that was the main source of food for the plains. Or a big source of food, that and deer, right, for the plains native peoples. And so, you know, and the army deliberately destroyed the buffalo herds, you know, same as with, I mean, it's a great military tactic, right? How do you defeat anybody that's going to bear arms against you? Well, how about destroy their food source? You know, that kind of thing.
Why wasn't? Yeah. So what is the how today, man, the same thinking, hunting and corralling and keeping people fenced in. So the barbed wire fence in terms of how a city is run. So that whole metaphor, like they use zip codes.
Yep.
They use zip codes as the management, as the cowboy, like this.
Sure. In this zip code, you know, we are not going to insure property except at a high rate. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that zip code, well, there's a low risk. Well, you know, but they use like there's all kinds of racial and probably other income related prejudices built into all that, right? I mean, biases. You know, people that have less money are going to be more likely to be late paying their loans or debts. I love the way the business guys think that any problem is also an opportunity. You know, no matter the consequences of it are not so much important can I make a killing here? Oh yeah, there's a lot of people not paying their debts in zip code, 22222, right? And why don't we just charge a higher interest rate for everybody who lives there? You know, regardless of whether, person A has paid all their debts on time, okay? I mean, there's somebody in their neighborhood that's not paying your debts, but because they're not paying your debts, well, you get to pay a higher interest rate too because you're in the same neighborhood. That doesn't even actually need much comment, so.
I'm trying to get some questions here. So, John, what we got? 7:23. So, you come up 7:30. Open up.
Well, I should let you know a couple of things here that just give you something to think about, maybe. Dr. Aldous is going to be on our Labor Beat program next Tuesday.
Great.
And he is he's become active in this. Positions for National Healthcare, PHNH. Yeah, I think that's what it is. So they want to basically put the insurance companies out of business and have what they call a single payer, at least out of the healthcare business, and have a single payer solution that's basically a government-backed insurance company. Basically, okay. So it's not going to be operated for profit directly. I'm sure they're going to try to not operate it at a loss, but maximizing the profit's not if it's government insured. It's kind of like the old AT&T monopoly, right? You know, where in exchange for being a monopoly, the government said, "Well, okay, you can be a monopoly," but back then they said you have to give every person, no matter whether they can pay a bill or not, a dial tone, so they can call emergency services or the local school or help.
Oh, okay, that was
right. Or whatever. Oh. Okay, maybe you wouldn't be able to make a long distance call to Germany if you. but okay, you had to have dial tone service for absolutely everybody. That was the deal. That you get you get to have a monopoly, and of course, in exchange for doing that, I mean, the AT&T used to negotiate with the government every year some period of time. Well, what's the fair profit, the fair rate of return going to be? 10%, 8%, something, right? They'd also get guaranteed profits,
So what's that agency called? The agency that gives us the names of some of the things you just talked about, like they're responsible for what the percentages are going to be.
Well, that would be that would have been the for AT&T. It would have been the Commerce Commission, Department of Commerce. They're the ones that determine whether you can operate at a tax rate or whether you can be a Well, and also this, you'd have to have some protection legally from antitrust. You're a trust, okay? You have a monopoly. What that means is that you need to either be regulated or broken up. If you're not going to be broken up into different companies, well then you got to be regulated. Because you're the whole public's going to rely upon a single supplier of a necessary service, right? A service that's become necessary, not just optional, phone service in the 50s, right, or 40s and 50s. So, there you go. Now, I mean, healthcare, right? So if you're going to have a single payer on healthcare, you're going to set up a national health service, and that's going to basically take the place of Medicare and Medicaid, and probably Medicare Part B, you know, the positions part as well. And then, you know, you can, you're going to have, then you'll be, the market will be reduced to luxury, or what do they call them? Not luxury, cosmetic? Is that like cosmetic surgery? Things like, I mean, that's a whole area, right, that would not be insured by the government. So there would there would be services, medical services that might not be covered, but most things would be covered. Okay, so that's going to put the insurance companies out of business. I mean, the health insurance capital is the, I don't know what it is now. It used to be the third biggest resource of private capital in the country, right behind pension funds, and I can't remember what the big one was, bank, probably one of the financial services. But in any event, they're not going to take they don't take kindly to that, man. And they contribute a ton of money to both parties.
The insurance
industry, and their related ones, which are, of course, pharmaceuticals, which are directly related to, you know, what is the health industry, so-called, actually in business doing? Well, mostly they're giving you drugs. Right? I mean, there's some surgery and obviously analysis, but, you know, the remedy is mostly drugs.
And that's something.
And they make a lot of money out of that, you know.
I know. So Dr. Aldous is pretty cool, man. I've always enjoyed
it. Good guy.
Yeah. He was going to let us do a fundraiser, some me and some friends of mine. Actually, the Hope Dealers were two of them. I know you've heard of them.
Yeah.
And we were going to do a fundraiser in his yard. His yard is.
Doesn't he live down there on the River Road someplace?
In Shepherdstown.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so we went, and it was a nice layout, but it had a lot of hills and valleys. But he had it, you know, the way it's set up. You go down one hill, and there's a open space where you could put a stage and a microphone and all that stuff where people could gather. Then you got another flat space, but you got to go up another hill and down into a valley, and down there is where people could eat and everything. But there was no place to put any electricity or anything like that, so we couldn't.
Yeah.
And you know, they wanted to do a fundraiser. We went out there, spent a couple of hours touring his home. And the Hope Dealers, they wanted to do it. They wanted him to help sponsor it, you know.
Yeah.
And so they didn't want to try to come up with no money to get the equipment. You know, you need a stage, you got to get the sound, you got to get flyers. They thought we're going to have a picnic. The people ain't going to just come to the picnic and give you money. Anyway, so Dr. Aldous was like, and then the one lady, he started really disliking her, because we were still working, going up to the hospital in Martinsburg and going to all these meetings and everything. And Dr. Aldous just hated it when this particular lady
Do I know her? Okay. Well, never mind. We won't name names. Okay. You can tell me later.
You know,
I just got a picture in my mind of some people.
And it was like, I spent a lot of time in damage control.
Yeah.
You know, you get hooked up with some groups, man, and you end up in complete damage control. If you don't have that piece in place, you end up getting the short end of the stick, because your reputation, people don't want you to come over no more. You know, people don't want you in their yard changing things. You know, like somebody come in your house and cut the television on.
Well, here's a reaction to that. You know, for example, I got a big, well, don't know what I wouldn't call it a lecture. You know, my friend Joe Sims. He was giving me a little bit of a lecture. Yeah, you know, on the issue of what he called collectivity, and you know, that if you that nobody has the answers to, I mean, his position was nobody has the answers to all the questions, all right? And it's a process of trying to find as big, like, for example, you take any two people, right, and they might have a dispute about something. Even if they have more or less similar, you know, economic standings. I'm not talking about necessarily a rich person and a poor person, but people that are in the same, you know, baseball field somewhere, okay? And they have a dispute that they can't resolve, you know, that mm-hmm. difference of opinion, and one thinks it's really important, the other mm-hmm. thinks it's kind of important from their point of view. But anyway, there's no common ground.
Some people,
so they start the separation. So his mm-hmm. point was that, well, if you ask 1,000 people about this same opinion, then one of two things is going to happen. One thing is that it's either going to become not much of a problem at all, compared to all the other problems that might rise up for the 1,000 people, right? Or it's going to turn out it's a really important issue, and a lot of people are going to start lining up if you start asking them, you know, about this or that, you know. And either way, he says, you can't find out unless you talk to the 1,000 people.
You talk to 1,000 people. So we got work to do. Let's get going.
You know,
let us go. That's a real...
I thought that was a pretty interesting point about, I mean, he had another point to make too about it, but namely, it's like, for example, in the labor movement, there's a tradition that can easily turn into a kind of a bureaucracy, but that is founded on the idea that the only power that ordinary working people have, if they don't have a lot of savings and assets and mobility, whatever, is their solidarity. That's their power. You know, if they can get
solidarity.
A whole bunch of people to stand together, then work doesn't get done. And the whole point, and there's not much value in an economy if people mm-hmm. aren't working, okay? So how do you, but that solidarity requires that even if you disagree on some point, okay, that you say, well, for this time, for now, maybe for a lifetime, but regardless, in this cause, we will act all as one. And that requires considerable discipline, you know, and a sense of, you have to have some trust. I mean, how does a leadership gain that kind of trust, okay, to say it's time that we all do this together and that we do not break? And the only way you can do that is if the leadership has actually been consulting all these people. Yeah,
one at a time.
Yeah, really, one at a time. You can't, you know, or if you have an organization, have you, as you go one layer down in your organization, is that part of your organization also of a mind to, before they make a decision, to consult as many people as they possibly can, okay, to make sure
you're keeping honestly to
find out whether or not, you know, what you see as the big problem, is it really the big problem, or is something else the big problem? And because if you can't get that solidarity going, you can't win. On the other hand, you know, after the fight's over, you end up with a pretty top-down organization when it's not doing much. Okay, I mean, you end up, you have officers, right? You collect dues, you know, you hopefully don't have to stay on strike forever. I mean, you know, get you know, have things, your goal is to get back to some livable normality of some kind, right? And during those times, of course, it gets, you know, a lot of shit can happen, and you, the organization gets weaker, you know.
It's weaker,
In a sense. I mean, it may still stand up and make statements, but it gets weaker. Yeah. And so then you have another big challenge that comes along. All of a sudden, everybody's going to get their, you know, their income or livelihoods wiped out. And the same process happens again. And a lot of times, you know, the leadership that's been there in between, and they've forgotten how to do that, and they have to be basically thrown out and replaced with people that are ready to roll, okay? If it's a new fight, right, kind of thing.
It's a brand new day. It's a new day. It's a new song.
Anyway, his point was is that if you don't have, if you can't get that kind of so-called collectivity solidarity going, you can't win.
Collective solidarity.
I mean, you can get.
You have
can still
to keep
have
an
a,
eye on that.
You do.
You have to keep an eye on that too.
It's hard
to
build.
You have to keep an eye on that. Yeah, yeah. Because as soon as you get, and it to maintain.
Right.
Let's talk about maintaining it. We've gotten it built, metaphorically speaking. It's built.
Right.
It's, you know, we've had the launch. We got solidarity here now.
Yeah.
And solidarity has took a front seat in the leadership of this nation. Solidarity has built itself around us. Now we must maintain solidarity. We've moved into the 9th or 10th month of walking and talking strong in solidarity. So tell us, John, how is it sustainable?
Well, I don't know that it is infinitely. I think the main thing is that how easy is it for ordinary people in the multitudes, if they need to influence events? And to change that leadership, you know, how do you make a democracy in this sense work? Okay, the people's will gets refreshed. Okay, because every time you got young people coming in, you know, a next generation, everybody knows that, you know, I would say half the kids that are born, probably more than that, probably 3/4 of the kids that are born are going to find out who they are by saying, well, I'm not my parents. I'm something else, you know, and that doesn't mean they hate their parents, but I'm not that. I'm something new. Yeah. I'm something different. I'm, you know, and so there's that process of negation that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Right.
Process of negation.
Yeah. I don't know what I am yet. I'm trying to find
myself.
We'll
circle back to that one, but that's a really another good one. So, John.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
you got to have room for that. How do you have room for that? Okay. So the youth who are idealistic, but are seeing new things that you don't see, that you're seeing it through lenses that are now 40, 50, 60 years old. And, you know, you've learned to classify things in a way that makes sense to you, or at least most of it makes sense.
Yeah, Louis Armstrong said it best. I've started to watch babies grow. What a wonderful world. You remember Louis did that?
Oh, I do.
He said they'll learn things that I'll never know, something like that. But it was great. Right on, John. Didn't mean to interrupt, but let's go.
That's okay. How do remember Lewis's sustainability? You ever listen to hear Lewis talk about how he how Hello Dolly got famous?
Well, Hello Dolly.
You look swell, Dolly.
Darling, it's so nice to have you back where you belong.
Well, he says he went to some place. They were touring someplace. Somewhere near Chicago, but not in Chicago. It was in Illinois someplace. And they got on the stage, and somehow the crowd started yelling, play Hello Dolly. Play Hello Dolly. And Lewis looked back to the band, and he says, what the fuck are they talking about? And one of the band members says, we had a song that had that. It wasn't named that. Said, I think one of the other band members said, it wasn't named that, but we had a song that where we sang that back in New York 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. He said, really? Anybody got the music to it?
Yeah. Yeah, he was a classic, man. He had to learn how to shift on the road, much like you and I do, man. We take the show on the road, and John and I shift it around. You don't know what gear we in when we go out here. So when you're going to ride with us, better buckle up. Hey, so John, sustainability.
Yeah.
Now, we got the built. We got the, you know, it's been launched. You know, we got some solidarity going. Solidarity is walking both shoulders squared in the face of all kinds of adversity. I mean, and you can see that solidarity really works. But then you got the dismantlers. They're up the road.
They are.
Those that dismantle solidarity. And they do it well. It's like the Green Beret of dismantling stuff. You come in with a bunch of lies and set people up and talk to them in a way. Curtis Mayfield says it best. I'm so glad I've got my own. So glad that I can see. My life's a natural high. The man can't put no thing on me. And then he says, ain't it kind of funny how the man takes your money? As sure as he can be in a way you've never seen. Those are the dismantlers. They come at you firing rockets, dismantling your health care.
Yep.
You know,
well, dismantling and just promoting division. Well, and promoting division.
Promoting division. Yep. That's always put in the right left pocket of the dismantler.
Yeah,
so
right.
If you run up against him, go for the left pocket, first of all, because that's the thing he's going to try to hit you with.
Trump's a great example of, you know, applying that little tactic.
He has this relationship. I don't know how they built that thing or where they got it from, but it's a relationship with the truth that seems to impact people in such a way that they turn into these zombies. I will believe in the lie. I will believe in the lie. I walk left and right with the lie. Yeah. And then the lie will even make you yawn.
It will.
The lie will put you to sleep.
I used to have to hard lie. You know, a lot of times you when you hear the same thing over and over again, and the thing that struck me all the time was how anytime that the president or whatever had decided to go to war, it was almost unanimous that the media would chime in and print anything that the State Department sent them. I mean, anything, you know. I mean, I remember there was a New York Times correspondent during the Iraq thing that basically got a Pulitzer Prize for shit about remember the yellow cake and all the other, you know, stuff about the supposedly Saddam Hussein had. Well, all of it turned out to be horseshit. And, but nonetheless, the woman that got a Pulitzer Prize one of these prizes for journalism, and all she didn't investigate any of that shit. You know, all she did was take whatever the State Department told her and wrote it up. Pretty much as given. And
I guess it was pretty simple to do that back then. They had no checking ability. Right.
How do you verify?
And the only people that even got that information to where it really mattered at all were the people who made the decisions at the top to let this stuff filter through.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the right people are going to see it, the right people are going to react to it. Yeah. And so that's the systematic.
Dick Cheney.
They come up with these ideas, man, and that's why they have, you got these 500-page documents in the first. And the regular guy going to say, man, what the hell am I going to read? I'm not reading no 500 pages. You can't hardly get people to read.
read
4
pages. I don't have
pages,
time for that,
you know? You know, I mean, come on. So you bring this pile of, like you call it, John, horse shit to me.
Okay.
And put it on my desk. Put it in front of me. They read this. Read some through this.
Study it
shit.
Carefully. Mm. Study it carefully. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It'll be a test.
And you get to the middle. And you get to the middle. Just take your time. Slow down. Because there's a big pile of shit right in the middle.
Yeah, right. Slow down. Yeah, go real slow with that.
Yeah. Go real slow because you don't want to slosh it around.
Don't leave that part that until you're done.
Metaphorically speaking. And don't let the kids get a hold of this thing.
Yeah, we're letting you in on a big secret here. Right. You know, but no, dangerous for children. No,
they get a hold of some of the top. Yeah, they get a hold of some of the toxic. The toxics. Do. Yeah, that goes with this manuscript. You know.
Anyway, it's like very difficult to. Believe that.
So this is not bash radio. We're not bashing. You know, we don't come out here to bash.
Although I did think that Dick Cheney was, every time he appeared on TV, he looked like he had just consumed a small child.
and they should look on the... So I liken that. You know, I met Newt Gingrich in Martinsburg, West Virginia.
Oh, really?
Newt Gingrich.
Oh, he
was at the Purple Iris.
Was he over?
You heard of that place?
Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah, right.
Purple Iris. He was over there. I got a picture. They were setting up to do a meet and greet during one of the political years.
Yeah.
And he was over there, and I got in the crowd. I think I was somehow I got back there in that event. I had on shorts, and I was dressed like I just come out of the kitchen, actually.
Yeah.
And man, I was on a mission, and I got a picture with him, right, standing by a barn, by a shed, at the Purple Iris, and I put under the picture, Newt is a hoot, and it got Newt is a hoot.
How long ago is this?
And this was like maybe 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
And I'm going to pull it up one day and stick it out there, because as soon as he makes the news again, that's when I'll go in my archives and find that picture. And I have, you know, I usually have a good time with it, because people said,
I haven't heard much from him recently at all.
Not lately.
He might not be.
Because he put his foot in some shit. He tried to when...
with Trump.
You know, when the thing first started, with Trump. He was trying to cover up something. He was trying to side up. You know, these guys are like chameleons, man. And then a chameleon, when his colors, the changing of his colors does not work for him, in that wherever he is, the chameleon will flee and find another place. A place
where it can hide.
And so, he goes. So that's what he's a chameleon. And so is a lot of people that are recognizably chameleons, like a lot of the guy in Florida at Santos. He goes where the wind blows, you know?
Yeah.
You know? And so...
Yeah, they're playing a little tune,
And it's,
but if they get elected, it's whoever backs them with the money is going to end up calling the most of the shots. Although... there's the classic example of Adolf Hitler, of course, who was backed completely by the Krupp. Yeah, I think he owned the steel industry in Germany, or most of it. And then the guy got out of control. He won't do what I say anymore. I'm sorry.
Hey, John. Richard Pryor was telling me, you know, Richard Pryor was basically the greatest. I guess you call it improvisation. No.
He could create
four or five people on the same stage, and he's the only person up there.
I know.
And I watched it. I watched how he put the stage together for two or three characters, who he played all of them right there on the stage before you.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And physical manifestation. Yeah, the real physical self. To me, this is because I think kind of weird. That he had five people up there, and I was following along with each character.
Right.
And the way he did it, so the improv, man, and I said, you know, how great is that? to be in our archive so we can look back. And he used a word. He said, ah, such and such and so and so was not an etymologist.
Yeah, well.
And yes. I said, well, okay. Now, this was like back in the, what, early 70s? And, you know,
yep.
I had never heard of a word such as that. What did it, you know, he said, I was not an etymologist. And so how, what did he know about something? But the way he put, way he set the stage had me. And I said, I listened to him with a different set of ears.
Of course, etymology, the same set of ears.
I don't have interchangeable.
Is that the roots of etymology? Is that the roots of words?
Correct.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Ding.
I sometimes get mixed up between ding, different ologies.
Yeah,
Carol
says,
why, what are you talking about, John?
and he put it in a, and like it didn't even matter. It just made sense. He moved from what in the, I guess, what do you call it, in the world of words, that urban language.
Okay.
Yeah. He moved from urban, to sophisticated, I guess you call it, to the aristocracy.
I don't say anything doesn't have more than five syllables.
Right. He moved
Mississippi.
From that.
That doesn't quite make it. Mississippi. 1, 2, 3, 4.
And people who could hear etymology heard that part of the joke.
Right.
And he set it up, man. And he was saying stuff, man, that's like profound. It's happening right now. He was talking about boxing at one point. Right. And he said while he was training, you know, he hit the bat, working out in the gym. But when he got in the actual ring to fight, he said, the bag started moving and hitting back.
It did.
and he said, he turned around to coach and he said, coach, what is this, man? He's swinging back. This shit hitting back. And so he said he didn't understand because he thought, you know, that shit wasn't supposed to be happening, like somebody moving.
Really, huh? That's, yeah, right. What happened?
That was just golden, man.
No, that's a great.
And so I'm thinking, man, in my mind, how all of the information back when information was put out in a certain, and it was isolated, and it was given only to a certain segment, the segment that you wanted to move forward.
All right. Right?
And so exactly. Now that we have information highways, you know, people can get information lickety split. I wonder what the etymology of lickety split would be. Where did they come up? Who came up with the lickety split? And
it's probably dirty.
Yeah, it's probably.
It's probably sexual. I mean, I think 3/4 of the humor in the human race is probably, you know, gender oriented or sexual in some way, and then you people don't want to say deliberately, so they say things that, you know, can be interpreted both ways. I mean, there's so much of that. Think about all the language that happens every day, and you know, almost anything can be turned into a sex joke without too much effort. So,
what a golden time, man. So how's your life been going, John, by the way?
Every day.
I talked to you last week.
Every day is gravy, you know.
Every day is gravy. Etymology,
it really is.
Folks.
I mean, Carol wants to retire. That's the main thing that's happening here. So when you retire, of course, your income gets cut in half, you know, so we have to figure out a way to, that's what we're doing now. Actually, we're trying to live on what would be a retirement income sort of now, so that when she comes home, although she's home most of the time.
Yeah.
But then, so you know, she told me she's going to retire.
Solution.
And yesterday someone offered her a job, you know, like a consulting job or something like that. Oh, wow. You know, I don't have to go anywhere. I can, you know, well, yeah, I might do that. I said, why don't you think about just retiring, you know, because.
I think I get in trouble, man, because I'm old, but I won't act like I'm old. My body won't, you know what I mean? So when I go around people, you know, they won't let me do old shit.
No, they just want me to do, they want you to do everything. Why don't you pull this wagon while
I'm tired, man. And so what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to get me a bunch of doctor's excuses.
Oh, right.
And
keep it in my pocket. Yeah,
and I'm going to have to show them, you know, I really want to, but it's against my doctor's advice. I can't move no kitchen chairs. I have to ride. I have to ride everywhere I got to go unless I choose to.
Exactly.
And it's a part of my prescription.
Yeah.
But no, but I'm just being facetious. I really embrace the idea that, you know, you and I are two old geezers and we get up bright and early, probably every day. I know I can probably catch you early every day.
Yeah, yeah. We're usually, well, you go to bed early too. I mean, we stop staying early, you know, so.
See, that's the downside for us. So, cause last night I didn't get done until after 11 o'clock with my activities,
but not by choice.
You got me? So you kind of fortunate in that arena.
I don't have their kids are, well, Ben's around the corner, but he's so far as, you know, he's him and his partner are employed. They don't like their job, though. You know, they lay off a lot of people. They want to maintain 24/7, you know, service for a student. There's a online university, American Public University.
Okay. Yeah,
people keep quitting because they don't like the shifts. The shifts are, you know, are basically all, well, they've stopped doing overnight. So I think they shut down around midnight or something. But now they're shutting down earlier because they just don't have the people. And they can't hire, they won't hire them. And their stock price has gone from, I don't know, been cut in half over the past year or two. It's hard to, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell what that means. But it usually means you're losing financing ability, right? You know, if you go in for a loan, they say, well, what's your stock price? Well, it's $50 a share. Well, we'll give you the equivalent of half that, you know, so we don't get killed when the stock market crashes, you know, on your stock. But you can use that as collateral, right? Or a certain percentage of it as collateral. Mm-hmm. But when your stock price goes down, well, your credit line goes down too, basically. And there's a lot of people, a lot of companies that are using borrowed money for, especially as they can get it at low interest rates, which before the Fed started doing what they're doing now to fight inflation, it was really low back then. I mean, you know, you almost like you weren't partly paying interest at all. If you were a bank institution, if you were a customer, you're probably paying 3 or 4%. But
that's a lot of skin. Hey, talk to me, John. You mentioned something several years back, I believe. It's a couple of years back, about having some skin in the game, and it's not mine. Talk to me about what does that mean exactly? I got some skin in the game, and it's not mine.
Well, I mean, if you got skin in the game, meaning when the game is if the game is lost, you're gonna bleed. That's what it means.
Somebody's not going to bleed. Not me. I just.
Well, somebody's got skin in the game, which means that, you know, you go out threatening, like you're a country and you go out threatening people and all of a sudden one of your soldiers gets killed. Okay, you got skin in the game now. If you back up, the guy died for nothing. If you go forward, someone else is going to die.
Someone else is going to die. That ties right into that metaphor with how do you get the solidarity? How many people have to die before we
and
reach...
for what?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ultimately, ultimately the for what matters. Okay, I mean, it might not matter on the battlefield or in a day-to-day decision or something, but ultimately, if it's for nothing, if it's for something that's not worth dying, not killing people for, then it'll come back and hit you, and it did, like Vietnam, okay? I mean, it came back and hit the country right in the friggin' chest.
Mm.
I mean, it did.
That's a lost
in the game. A lost war.
A lost war.
You know, that scar does not go away. And
abandoned war.
Right.
They abandoned it or
lost it. I mean, it doesn't, whether they left the field and they shouldn't have, or they left the field, or they should have left the field before. whatever. And you leave people behind, which violates, that violates the solidarity principle.
Yeah. Right.
Leaving people behind. Okay. That hurts.
Open that hamburger up, right up on Hamburger Hill.
That's right.
I don't know. And so Dr. Aldous, John, switching gears again, Dr. Aldous, he's a great, great guest. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to see if I can.
Well, tune in on Tuesday. On Tuesday, we do it at 9 a.m., by the way, not
9 a.m. on Tuesday.
Yeah, because I can't get JB to wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning. So.
9 a.m. Yeah, he's a good guy. So
it's time for us to wind it up. Actually,
start
we've been
my
on
job
an hour.
At 2 o'clock.
Are you? By the way, you let me stop the recording for a minute here.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be okay. Yeah. Do you? Did you get that gig down here? Or you were looking?
I did. I was just going to tell you that I'll be starting my full shift Monday at 4 o'clock, from 4 to 12.
So
we're in good shape. We're in good shape.
All right.
Yeah,
man.
We're gonna. And it's pretty interesting, the set of circumstances surrounding this particular job, and what I see as a fun time for a minute. I don't know how long it's gonna last, but right now I'm okay with what's going on. So
right.
We'll be able to continue our journey.
All right, I'll get this posted today sometime. Okay.
Okay.
All right, buddy.
All right.
Take care, man.
Okay, John.
Love and peace. Peace and love.
Love and peace. Yeah, peace and love.